And I am starting the recording, just so you know, everybody's aware. Good? Okay. So last time around, after we got through all of the introduction, we started talking about the importance of Shabbos, just as a function of the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people. The reason we were looking at that is in order to understand how, when we talk about overriding Shabbos for the sake of saving lives, it isn't just like, oh, okay, so Shabbos can be overridden. It's actually, Shabbos matters a lot. It's just that saving lives also matters a lot. I actually was writing in this morning, and I got an email from somebody who's not from here at all, but he listened to the recording, and he's Lubavitcher, I think. So he sent me something from Lubavitcher Rebbe saying that, I'm going to get it wrong if I quote it without actually looking at it. So I'm just going to take a fast look at it to make sure that I don't get it wrong. His statement from the Rebbe was essentially that Shabbos is a sign of the relationship between the Jews and Hashem, and saving a Jewish life is the greatest expression of that relationship with Hashem. So that saving a life is not violating Shabbos, but it's an expression of Shabbos, which is a very nice idea. It also warns you that people are actually listening to the recording beyond the group that's here. But we emphasize the halachic importance of Shabbos as well as the philosophical importance of Shabbos. We talked about the penalties for violating it. We talked about how there are malachos, things you're not supposed to do on Shabbos, and there's also creating the atmosphere of Shabbos, this idea from Ramban, right? Does this ring a bell? Right? Yeshaya used Shabbos as the example of all the mitzvos that detail our relationship with Hashem, right? That rings a bell also. Okay? And then on the other hand, we started talking about the obligation to protect our health and how we have numerous passages from the Torah and statements of Chazal to tell us you have an obligation to protect your life, and not only, like life and death, protect your life, but protect your health overall. You're not supposed to do things that will diminish your function. So there is clearly a boundary here, in the sense that you can't really say don't do anything that's going to inhibit your function ever, because you won't live life that way, right? I mean, that's not the way life works, right? I mean, everybody does something. You stayed up late one night, and now you're not functioning well the next day. Did you really violate the halacha? Because now you diminished your ability to function. That's a really hard thing to say. So there is a little bit of a gray area. But basically, we have an obligation to preserve our health. It will enable us to continue functioning as people, as Jews, in our role in the world. Clear? Good? Okay. So moving on from that, the last piece in this introductory segment, and then we'll do that quiz that I talked about. And again, for those who are new, you won't have to answer the questions on last time stuff, but you will have to answer the questions on everything going forward from here. The obligation to heal others. How do I know that I have an obligation to take care of the health of people besides myself? Yeah. So Bikur Cholim is a good example, right? We said last time that there is a mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. There is a mitzvah of looking after people who are sick. Can you give me a pasuk, though? Because Bikur Cholim is sort of general chesed. We mentioned that last time. It's sort of general, be nice to other people, which is good. Can you give me a pasuk that says, look out for the health of others? And I'm going to ask for people to do names, even though I know Ricky, Karina, but nonetheless, yeah.
I'm Ricky.
Yes.
And I don't know the exact pasuk, but it's the one where, like, you shouldn't put a stumbling block in front of someone.
Ah. Right. So good. So one pasuk that we mentioned last time, the protective pasuk, says when you build a house, you have to make sure that any areas that have a drop off to them are fenced in. And if you don't, you're guilty of placing blood on your house. You place blood, you create a situation in which somebody could be harmed. So that would be one example. Good. You're going to say, or that was the same thing? Okay. Naomi, and then. Lo samod al dam reyecha. We're going to come back to that one. Don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed. Okay. Sorry, yeah, I know what to say. I'm going to get it wrong.
Daniela.
I was going to say Ruthie, and I said, it's not Ruthie. Is it Daniela? Okay, Daniela. So, Hishamar Lecha, Shmor Nafshecha, which we did last time, is about guarding your own health. I'm asking now, how do I know I have an obligation for somebody else's health? So, in other words, what we had said last time about Bikur Cholin.
Yeah.
Right. But what Ricky pointed out, that's Natalie, right? Okay. So, these are all true. I'm going to go more basic. Exactly. Right? Love your neighbor as yourself. You have an obligation to look after the welfare of others. I think that's a good kind of catch-all one. But it's true. I mean, the ones that were quoted were right. Lo sasim damim beveisecha, not to create a hazardous situation in your home, certainly qualifies as a source. And then we get to the one that was just mentioned before. I think Naomi mentioned it. Velo samot al dam riyacha. Take a look at the first source, please. This is a very, very important Gemara. The Gemara says, how do we know that someone who sees another person drowning in a river, being dragged by a beast, beset by bandits, how do you know that you have an obligation to act to save that other person? And the Torah says, like we quoted, "Velo sa'amod al dam re'acha, you shall not stand by the blood of your peer." You see somebody in danger, you have an obligation to act. Now, I'll introduce a tangential point here. Tell me something. How would you save somebody who's drowning in a river? What would you do? Sorry? Get a lifeguard. Sorry?
You'd have to swim.
Right? I mean, it depends a lot on the situation, obviously. Can you throw them a line? Is there a life preserver you can throw them? Yeah. Exactly. I'm not going to get it wrong. You're just going to tell me.
Ella,
thank you. That was actually what I was going to say. But there is a potential for harming yourself. And then you look at the other examples here. Someone's being attacked by bandits, right? Unless you have special training, a weapon, or whatever it is, you're endangering yourself in order to save them. They're being attacked by wild animals. You're as vulnerable to wild animals as they are, again, unless you have the training, the equipment, some position of safety from which to operate. My point is simply to say, this is more than just look out for people. It may even entail risk, and then there's a debate about how much risk you have to take on. You have the sheet from last time. Is that the situation?
No. Oh, that's where we are.
Oh, I'm starting from the beginning. Yeah, each time I'll try to start from the beginning.
Okay.
That's always a good place to start. Yes.
Julie,
thank you.
So, if like someone's in like a dangerous situation, but it's going to risk your life, not necessarily, like, how do you know which life to choose?
Right, so this is where things get very difficult. There's a classic Gemara involving Rabbi Akiva and someone named Ben Pictura. Anybody know the Gemara about the two people who are walking in the wilderness and they only have enough water for one of them? So those who said, what's the conclusion there? Yeah. So you choose yourself, right? That's what Rabbi Akiva says. Sorry, you were going to say? Same thing?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Lishaba,
got it. Okay, sorry. I'm going to get it, really. The rule is that, as Rabbi Akiva says, if there's only enough water for one of you, and you are holding the water, you drink the water yourself. Your life comes first. Where it gets tricky is, what if there either could be enough water, you don't really know. I'm walking in the wilderness, and I have no idea how long it's going to be until I get where I'm going. I don't know. Or what if the resources are not in my hand? The resources are, you know, out of both of our hands and we're both going for the resources. Then do I still have a right to say I'm taking it for myself? This becomes very relevant with things that happen every day, such as kidney transplants, right? A person donates a kidney to save somebody else's life. Well, kidney transplants are, on the scale of things, at this point, thank God, relatively safe. But still, like, you are taking something out of yourself. There's no situation in which that's 100% safe. You're undergoing some level of risk. to save somebody else. Then you start getting into cost-benefit analysis. Well, it's a low risk for me, and if they don't get the kidney, then they're going to die. Now what do I do? That kind of thing. Yes. Right. Name first, please.
Shira,
thank you.
Once you decide, I will give the kidney, what I'm thinking is, you're on the list or whatever, and you take the kidney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you drink the water. Are there, rules, on how you go about that?
Yes. Yes. For starters, you can't say, ha ha, I got water, you don't, and then dump out the last few drops just to, you know, not a nice thing to do. There are. And realistically, the case that involves Rabbi Akiva is a hypothetical. Meaning, you're not really going to see that happen in a situation where you know how far it is and you know there's just enough water. You know, it's trying to set down a principle as opposed to practical, here's what you'll do in that situation. That requires more specific guidance. It's true. So this is a very important Gemara. This is a very important Pasuk. It tells me I'm not allowed to turn away when somebody else is at risk. That's number one. Number two, there's also a mitzvah aseh. There's a commandment. It's called Hashavas Aveda. Hashavas Aveda means?
Returning a lost object.
Exactly, returning something that's lost. The Torah says, V'hashevo solo. You should restore people's property to them. Says the Medrash in source number two. This is a Sifri. It's a Medrash that teaches halacha on, in this case, Sefer Devarim. V'hashevo solo. The Torah says, when you see that somebody when you see somebody else's property, you shall restore it to him. And the Medrash says, the word Vahashevo so is a funny word for the Hebrew speakers. If you wanted to say, return it to him, would you say the Hashevo so, Lo? Or what would you say? Hashevo. It'd be Vahashevo, Lo. Hashevo so, Lo is an odd word. Says the Medrash, restore himself to himself. Meaning, your obligation is to restore people to their former state, whether that's by giving them back their property or whether it's by giving them back their health. Yes, Ariana.
If you, let's say a doctor is treating someone and they mess up because a room makes mistakes, and you try but you couldn't fully heal them, do you still get some I tried to heal them, but am I able to do it if I pass someone else? You still have that I tried my best to try to heal them, but I couldn't do it? Or is it just once you heal them fully, that's when you get you heal them also?
Right, so we believe that Hashem gives partial credit. You get credit for making the attempt, for the training you put in, for the effort that you expended. There's a whole halachic discussion about malpractice. What's the liability for a medical professional who messes up? And the general principle is, if you did your training properly, kept up on the field, learned what you needed to learn in order to practice well, and you weren't careless, you're not liable. You're not responsible for what happened. You may want to atone between yourself and Hashem and say, I'm so sorry, and do something as a kapara. But from a pure, based-in perspective, you're not liable because you did everything possible to ensure this person would be safe. And yes, there's absolutely credit for making the attempt. Okay. So that's a little bit of how we know you have an obligation to heal. Look in source number three. This is from the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch says, regarding this mitzvah of healing people, have people here I know there's a little bit of a range of background in the class, and we've got some people who come from a stronger and some people who come without as much background. You know what the Shulchan Aruch is? You've used the Shulchan Aruch? It's okay to say no. Tiny bit of background, just because otherwise a lot of this becomes incomprehensible. You start out with Tanakh and the Gemara. Okay? The Gemara being the written version of all the halakha that had been passed down verbally through the ages. How it gets to be in the Gemara's form, way beyond the scope of this class. I'm fairly sure there are other classes here, though, that will discuss that. In order to draw halacha from the Gemara, you need to basically know all of it. And you need to understand it enough to be able to say, oh, this is the conclusion. There's a debate between that one and that one. This is the conclusion. They brought a proof this way. That means this is it. Things like that. It's hard to get halacha out of the Gemara. If you only know one Gemara that you learned, you may not know three others that give you nuances that affect how you understand the conclusion. So what do? So after the time of the Gemara, starting in the 7th century, you have a period known as the period of the Gaonim. The Gaonim were the heads of yeshivot, centered primarily in Bavel, what is today Iraq, but not exclusively Bavel. There were in Tunisia, there was one in Israel. But the Gaonim start to produce works of halacha, but they're still very hard to use. The first work of halacha that we would recognize today as, oh, I can use that without a lot of strain, would be the Rambam, even though there are other works of halacha all along, but this isn't a class on history of halacha, so I'm skipping them, with apologies to them. But the Rambam is the first one that you could really use easily, because what the Rambam does is he divides halacha into sections by topic. So he'll say to you, you want to know about Shabbos? In this section, I have halachos of Shabbos, and it's in chapters, and they're numbered. And so the Rambam becomes very useful. The Rambam's work of halacha is called, anybody know? Mishnah Torah. That's one name for it. The other name is? Yad HaChazakah. Right, very good. The mighty hand, because it has 14 sections, which is Yad. So Yad HaChazakah is another name for the Mishnah Torah. It is the Rambam's attempt to condense and provide for you halacha. That is produced in the 12th century. However, it doesn't deal with all cases. It doesn't bring sources. And there are others at the time of the Rambam who disagree with him. And so what you have happen is a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yaakov ben Usher, coming along in the 14th century, says, we need something in addition to the Rambam. And he writes what's called the Tur. Okay? This is not on a quiz. This is just stuff to know. And not because of the class, but because Jews should know this. So the Tur revolutionizes how you learn halacha in the sense that, among other things, and there are a few things about it that are unique, but the thing that matters for our purposes is he divides all of halacha into four areas. One is called Arach Chaim, which means path of life. One is called Yoredeya. I'm going to come back to that one. One is called Ge'er Choshen Mishpat. This is about business law in various ways, various kinds of commerce. And the other one is Eben HaEzer. Good. Eben HaEzer is about marriage issues, primarily. Yoredeya is the one that's hardest to explain in simple English. It's about Isser V'Heter, that which is prohibited and that which is permitted. So Kashrus is there. Taras Mishpacha, Mikvah, that's there. Ribbis, not lending people money and charging interest, is also in Yoredeya. Avelus, mourning, is in Yoredeya. Yes?
What is it that's in Yoredeya? Like, what's the general topic?
Isser v'heter, that which is prohibited and permitted, which is a very clumsy term. Like, what does that exactly mean? But that's why I'm giving you illustrations. So the end of Yoredeya is very important for anyone who wants to know anything about medical halacha, because the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim is there. So some aspects of Bikur Cholim are relevant for medical halacha. Arach Chaim is very clearly relevant for medical halacha because it includes daily life. Davening is there, but it also includes Shabbos, and it includes Yom Tov. So we're going to be spending a lot of time in Arach Chaim. We'll be spending less time in Choshen Mishpat and Eben HaEzer. We wanted to talk about the doctor who messed up and the malpractice issue. That's going to be in Choshen Mishpat. So there's a lot of medical halacha in Eben HaEzer. All discussions about things like IVF and fertility treatments and whatever, that's all in Eben HaEzer. So you see a lot of that. Sorry?
But we're discussing specifically Shabbos.
Right, we're doing medical treatment on Shabbos, so that becomes less relevant. Okay, sorry. It's a side note, but I sort of felt like we should make sure we're on the same page and knowing sort of what books we're quoting. So that's the Tur. Rabbi Yosef Karo lives in Israel. I think he's originally Turkey, but he ends up in Israel in the 16th century. And he does a remarkable thing. He might have been originally in Egypt. He's in a few places. I thought his last stop before Israel was Turkey.
I thought the whole Cairo thing was Egypt.
It was from...
Oh, no, it's not.
Oh,
no, that's not.
I think he was
no. No. Like there is a city named Cairo. However, I don't believe that's where it comes from. I believe Kara is actually, or Cairo was actually the original. It wasn't because of Cairo. Yeah, I believe that's true. Although I have seen people spell it that way, but yeah. So, so Rav Yosef Karo writes a commentary on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah called Kesef Mishneh, providing the sources for the Rambam's rulings. He writes a commentary on the Torah called Beis Yosef, where he digests for halacha and brings you debates and so on. And then he writes something called the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, as they translate it, although that's actually not what the word Shulchan Aruch means. Shulchan Aruch means a set table, in which he's trying to digest for you practical halacha. He uses the same structure as the Torah, and it's really, like, if you want to know anything in Jewish law, you look at the Shulchan Aruch. Now, that's in the 16th century, so there's a lot of stuff that's been written since then. And there are new questions and new cases and new technologies. But you need to go to the Shulchan Aruch to know what you're doing. Got it? Okay. I hope I didn't fall into the trap of being, you know, too slow for the people who know it and too quick for the people who are actually learning from it, you know, to be useful. But, I don't know. Yes.
Sorry, what was Evan Ezer?
Evan Ezer, like marriage, divorce type stuff. Okay. So, going back to what I wanted to show you from Shulchan Aruch, take a look at source number 3, where we are told the following. The Torah permitted a doctor to heal. The reason he has to say permitted is because there's actually a Gemara that says we know doctors are permitted to heal because the Torah talks about doctors. When the Torah talks about if you attack somebody else and injure them, not that you ever should, you're responsible to pay their medical bills. So the Gemara says, oh, I guess that means that halacha recognizes doctors, because otherwise why are there medical bills? So so he says the Torah permits a doctor to heal, and it's a mitzvah, and it's part of saving lives. One who refrains is spilling blood. And even if he has someone else to heal him, they don't need me. There's another doctor. Doesn't matter. You have to do it. One may not merit to be healed by everybody. Maybe the doctor who's treating has never seen this case before. Maybe the doctor who's treating is tired. Maybe the doctor who's treating, for whatever reason, isn't suited to take care of this, whether on a very human level or Hashem wants you to be the one to do it, and therefore you have a responsibility to act, and failure to do so is spilling blood. Yes?
But you mentioned that even if they have never seen this case before, why would they take care of it if they can extend it onto something
that? Well, you can have a scenario where they feel like they're the only one who's on the scene. Let's say it's an airplane, right? And they put an announcement on the loudspeaker saying, you know, was there a doctor? Somebody passed out, whatever it is, right? So the first person who answers and says, well, I'm a doctor, doesn't yet know what they're walking into, right? So they go to the patient, and no one else answers because they see, oh, somebody already answered. But this doctor shows up and says, I've never seen this before. But no one else is getting up because they say, oh, somebody else took care of it. So that's why you're responsible to step forward and, you know, and make the attempt.
So every doctor on the plane, like, if something's going wrong, they have to all, volunteer themselves to help?
So they should notify the flight attendant that they're a doctor. You know, that doesn't mean you don't want to get into a situation which is counterproductive, right? If you've ever seen that, there's an accident scene and people flood it and it becomes like everybody tripping over everybody else. You don't want that to happen. But on the other hand, you do want them to know there's somebody here who's competent, who can, you know, who can help if needed. So this obligation to take care of the lives of others sounds at first like it's specifically where there's a threat to life. Sorry? Right, people who have the training, people who have the means, correct. Although, not necessarily. Like we talked about, don't stand by the blood of another. If you have any means of saving them when they're drowning, you don't need to be a doctor. You need to be somebody who just, you know, can do something. But take a look at source number 4 from the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg. He's talking about a different story altogether. He's talking about a father whose son is refusing a particular medical treatment. And the father wants to know, what's my obligation? Now, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg is a very big name in the field of medical halacha because, are you familiar with a hospital in Israel called Shari Tzedek Hospital? Have you heard of that? So Shari Tzedek Hospital has a shul across the street. I don't remember the name of the shul. But Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was the rabbi of that shul for decades. And for decades, doctors in the hospital would come to him to ask him their medical halacha questions. He passed away, I think it was 2003. And he dealt with major issues that came up over a period of decades and wrote a work of response of Chuvos that's more than 20 volumes. So there's a lot, I mean, it's not only about medical, but that's a major, major resource. It's called Tzitz Eliezer. He was so prolific, and his name is so known in this field, that there are people who think he was the posek of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. He actually was not the posek at that time. I'm told by doctors who were there. It was Rav Yitzchak Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak, who is another big name. But in any case, Rabbi Waldenberg, if you take a look at source number 4, talking about this case of the father who wants his son to have the treatment and the son is refusing, he says, when the father can convince the son to agree to accept the required medical treatment, he must do so. You have to do it as part of a general duty, meaning even if the kid has now grown up, he's no longer a little kid. If you can convince your son to get the treatment, you have a duty to do so. Why? Because he says, the Torah says, V'hashevo solo, you shall restore it to him. The pasuk that we brought in source number 2. Although in one case I translated it as return, in the other case I translated it as restore, but it's the same pasuk in the Hebrew. And as the sages taught, this comes to include healing his body. So the mitzvah of restoring people's health, I should clarify, the case he was talking about was not life and death. I believe it was a vision issue. The kid needed treatment for his eyes, if I remember correctly. It was dental. The point is, you have a duty to other people, not only in terms of saving their lives, but of preserving their health overall. Yes?
What if it was from
the Tova?
Yeah, Tova.
Okay, yes. What if it was from the Yeah, that gets very tricky. That gets very, very tricky. This question of what about when it's the parent who's not listening and the child knows that there is a particular medical need. This happens a lot. You have people whose parents smoke and the child wants to convince them not to. You have people whose parents eat things that they know, you know, the child knows this really isn't good for them. And there are often limits on what a child can do because parents aren't always willing to listen to their kids. They're used to the roles being reversed. And because the parent's been doing this for decades and isn't interested in changing. So, yes, the child may have a responsibility. No, the child may not be able to carry it out effectively. You know, the child may need to enlist other support to try to figure out what the best approach is. It's hard. It's not straightforward. Ricky?
But what is that line between, like, patient autonomy
and,
like, halakha?
Yeah.
Right.
So that's a really good question. Patient autonomy, I mentioned it briefly last time, is the principle, it's very much in vogue today, that the patient has the right to decide what they want, what should be done for them. That's a new thing in the world overall.
It's a thing in halacha as well. Like, if a woman is going through, like, a pregnancy, that, like, ultimately, and they tell them that it's okay to terminate, like, ultimately, it's her decision.
Right. So let's distinguish between two types of autonomy. In halacha, one type of autonomy is, Hashem says, everybody has bechira chofshis. Everybody has free will. There is a halacha for a given situation, and it's going to be on you to follow it or not follow it, number one. Number two, there is a degree in most halachic cases of subjectivity, which is going to be on you to report. So, for example, I know that if I'm in great pain, I'm allowed to do certain things on Shabbos. But who can tell me whether I'm in great pain or not? That's my subjective judgment. That's one area. But what we're talking about here is a different type of autonomy. What we're talking about here is medically you need X in order to survive. The doctor says, this is what you need in order to survive. But I can't tell you to take this. That's your decision about whether to do that. You know what the Hippocratic Oath is? What is the Hippocratic Oath? More or less. It's a Greek thing, which doctors have taken as an oath for a very long time, which says in its form, which said in its form until relatively recently, that basically the doctor is the one to decide and the patient doesn't get a vote. The doctor has to inform the patient of this is what you ought to do. Patient autonomy began when first of all, doctors were afraid of getting sued because the patient did something because the doctor told him to and it didn't work out well. And the doctor said, well, I don't want to be sued for that, so I'm not going to tell you to do anything. I'm going to tell you, here are your choices and you decide. Then I'm not responsible. After that, it then became an ethical thing of what people have their freedom and their rights and so on. Within halacha, there are areas, which we may even get to, although I'm not sure, where there is such a thing as you have the right to decide whether you want to proceed with treatment or not. There is such a thing. But there's also this very strong bent of, I have an obligation to tell people right and wrong. The Torah is a mitzvah of tochacha. I'm supposed to help people do the right thing. I'm supposed to avoid having people stumble. Well, that requires that I inform them when they're about to stumble. So it's not easy to carry it out. But I'm going too far afield. I want to get back to the Shabbos stuff. Aliza. So it's a good question. A lot depends on the maturity level of the minor, where the resistance is coming from. But yes, when you're dealing with a minor, not just in halacha, but in secular society as well, there's much more of a burden on the parent to say, look, you're living in my house, you're eating my food, I'm supporting you, and this is the way it's going to be. You're doing this. Right, so the whole question of when you stop being a minor is also interesting, but I want to get back towards this, because I'm going to have to give you a quiz. So again, we've talked about the seriousness of Shabbos, we've talked about the duty to protect our health, we've talked about the duty to heal others. So I have some questions, and I want you to take a few minutes to answer them. I don't want to take a ton of time. I'm not looking for you to write a Megillah, you know, on this. So thank you for taking the quiz. I will look at that, God willing, this evening, and hopefully all went well. We now shift to talk about what you do when these great values we've been talking about, Shabbos on the one side, health on the other side, come into conflict. And what we need to do, first and foremost, is weigh the level of medical need that's actually involved. There's a lot to talk about, and that's what we're going to be spending, you know, the next several classes on, is what does it mean when you say somebody is dangerously ill? What does it mean when you say somebody doesn't feel well? Like what, you know, what are these categories? But what I want to do now is just give an overview. Okay, that's the goal. If you look at your source sheet, jumping to after number 11, there's a table there. I gave you four basic categories. There are other categories you could add, but these are the four that are going to matter most for us. One, a person who is dangerously ill. We call it a chole sheyesh bo sakanas. That means somebody whose life is in danger. That's what we're talking about. The one below that is called sakanas aver, danger to an aver. Danger to an aver means, as I wrote in the cases column, a part of the body may lose ongoing function. We'll have to talk about that and where that fits and things. The third one is somebody who's ill, but they're not in danger. You know, they're not going to die on Shabbos. They're not going to die from this illness. It's not that type of a thing. However, as I wrote in the cases column, they're bedridden. Their entire body feels sick. And as we'll see, young children automatically may be in this category with their illnesses. And then you have somebody who's just in some pain. They're not in any danger. They're able to function. You know, they have a little bit of a headache. It's bothering them. That's mechush. Okay? So those are just, that's just an introduction to the basic categories that we're talking about here. It's really important that you get competent medical advice on any of these situations. Obviously, sometimes you hit a situation where you don't have the option of consulting somebody. But wherever at all possible, you need the medical professional to tell you if there is any danger, to tell you there isn't any danger, whatever it is. So the first and foremost, chole sheyeshbo sakana, somebody who is in fact dangerously ill. If you take a look at source number 5, I brought you the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo. He says it is a mitzvah to violate Shabbos for one who is dangerously ill. One who is energetic is praised. One who consults, who says, wait, should I, is shedding blood. Right? You may remember the source that I brought you the first week where we said that the rabbi who was asked this question is disgraceful because he should have let people know in advance that you break Shabbos in order to save lives. Nonetheless, the person who is asking is also wrong. If somebody is dangerously ill, you act. That was easy. Yeah.
I think it wasn't to be taken literally, but it said like the leaders of the communities, like the rabbis, should be the ones to.
Yeah, we have to talk about that.
Drive someone to the hospital to show that like you're supposed to bring Shabbos to do it, but doesn't that? I guess if it's metaphorical, then like doesn't actually, but like doesn't that then shed blood because you're taking more time to.
Correct. No, what it's trying to say there, it's a good question, and it's actually a deeper discussion to a certain extent of that passage, which we may get to, I'm not sure. But what this passage is trying to say is you don't say, well, let somebody else take care of it. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, you don't say, let me get a child to do it. You don't say, let me get somebody who isn't so careful about Shabbos in the first place to do it. You go, you do it, you take care of it. That's really what the message there is. And if you're not the one on the scene.
That's only for specifically people who have not
changed. Yeah. Which is what we're talking about when it comes to breaking Shabbos, but yes.
Because, like, no, like a whole shame was a kind of like.
Right.
Then, like, if it's like someone in the hospital, that's not, you're allowed to ask, a non-Jew to turn on the light.
Right. So when it's not dangerous or not time sensitive, you have options to play with, then take your options. Yes. Yeah. All right, I see several hands. Bailey?
Yeah. Okay. So you're saying that it's a mitzvah to violate Shabbos if it's like a severe situation, but the thing that's frowned upon is asking if you should violate Shabbos?
Correct. Now, if you legit don't know, I don't know if this is a dangerous situation or not, then your question is to the medical professional. The medical professional says, yes, this is dangerous, you go do. That's the way it works. Sorry, I'm forgetting. Nechama, okay. So that is an excellent question. In practice, absolutely. You're saving everybody. Why that's true requires that we discuss a long sugya that I hope to get to of why we violate Shabbos at all. How do I know that, in fact, saving a life overrides Shabbos when Shabbos is so important? So once we go through the discussion of how I know that you break Shabbos to save a life, we'll understand also why that's true for everybody. So we're going to get there, God willing, but we're not there yet. Sorry. Yeah.
Julie. So how are the doctors allowed to work on Shabbos if it's not necessarily
Jew? Right. So again, I said you save everybody, Jew and non-Jew. But there is more to say about doctors in hospitals and stages of training and so on, and we're going to get to that, some of that, I hope, in this semester. Yeah. Danielle?
Yeah. Okay. What if you're not dangerously ill, but you don't do anything about it?
So that's a topic we will talk about, God willing, the question of future harm. Yes. Ariana and then
yeah.
Layla, right?
Okay. How about when I'm talking to you, you go to the hospital, like if someone is not fit for Friday night, and then like after school they just like can't move, like do you just like wait that out because like, there's only a couple hours left, or like you just go away?
Right, so I hope to get to that also this semester. We'll see. Layla.
Okay, so I think we maybe basically say, depending on how old the person is, it depends on if you can treat it or not. So what about someone with, let's say, they were in Pensola and they respond with an ambulance, and sometimes people call with something that's not so serious? Let's say the EMT gets in, is it in the HLCL? Do they refuse care?
So they don't refuse care, but they care in a Shabbos appropriate way. You know, they'll do what they're able to do on Shabbos. So, you know, there are cases of broken bones which require getting serious medical treatment now because of the way the break is. There are cases of broken bones which, okay, fine, wait till after Shabbos. you know, I can't answer the question of which is which, that you need an EMT to be able to answer that. If you think it might be something that needs immediate treatment, you call Atzala, and, you know, they'll come make that assessment, and they'll treat in whatever way is appropriate.
Like, they make that assessment based off of their last question.
Yeah, correct. And, and keep in mind, they can always refer you to 911 or whatever it is. But, you know, I'm seeing a lot of hands, and I also want to make sure to go forward. So I'm going to ask just to keep the questions less on the what if and more about what we've just said. Are there questions that are about what we've just said? Okay, so I'm going to skip the what ifs for now. I do want it to be interactive. I said that last week. I also want to make sure that we, you know, cover some ground. So I'm trying to balance in between. I'm sorry. If people have a question that we don't get to during class and you want to email it to me afterwards, I'm totally fine with that. Many things we will get to, though, God willing, over the course of the semester. Okay, yeah.
I have a kind of, like, ambiguous question. It's like an if question, but it's not a what if question. If it's so important to, like, just do, act in the moment, okay, now I kind of feel bad because it's, like, a little bit mean, then, like, what's the point of, like, learning these emotions?
Because of
like,
two
no, things. I know it's important to learn.
No,
like, I'm not trying to like.
No. I understand what you're asking. The number one, because the more you know before the situation ever comes up, the better suited you are to actually deal with it and know, do I act now or do I not act now? Or if I am acting now, what's the way I'm supposed to? Because most cases that people will encounter in the course of their lives, certainly if they're medical professionals, but even if they're not medical professionals, most cases are not clear-cut. And most cases don't involve a threat to life. There are cases that do, but there are an awful lot of cases that happen that do not. So, you know, let's say there's a kid who's, you know, 3 or 4 years old, and he spikes a fever, 102. It's not life-threatening. You know, now what do I do? Do I give medication? Do I consult the doctor? Like, how do I handle it? So that's why you need to learn it. Okay. So that's the pikuach nefesh, let's save a life case. Then you have the case that is, frankly, more common, which is safek pikuach nefesh. Safek means?
Doubt.
I don't know if this is life and death. I'm just not sure. So I bring you another passage from the Shulchan Aruch. He's talking about somebody who is traveling with a caravan on Shabbos. In and of itself, it doesn't sound like a medical case. Right? They're traveling with a caravan through the wilderness on Shabbos. And there is a halacha of Tchum Shabbos. I'm not allowed to travel outside of civilization, so to speak, a city, a settlement, beyond a certain distance, roughly a kilometer, on Shabbos. That's called Tchum Shabbos. This has nothing to do with carrying or not carrying. Even if I'm not carrying anything, I'm not allowed to on Shabbos. But I'm on a caravan, and they're just going to keep right on going. What do I do? So the answer is, source number 6. Shulchan Aruch says, one should arrange with them to halt. Before you get on the caravan, yeah.
Can you just explain what the question is again?
Yeah. Okay, so I am living in, I mean, I'm going to pretend something now, okay? I'm going to pretend that the area between Manhattan and I don't know, let's say, the problem is you have too many bridges here. All right, you're in Chicago, okay? And you need to get to Detroit. And the area between Chicago and Detroit is very dangerous. There are bandits. There are wild animals. There are human beings. Whatever. You arrange with a caravan that you're going to travel with them from Chicago to Detroit. But you know that it's a multi-day trip. And you know that one of those days is going to end up being Shabbos. So what you want is to halt on Shabbos with the caravan. That's what you would like to be able to do. Because you're not allowed to travel in this caravan on Shabbos itself. Even though you're not doing malacha, you're traveling outside of the town, violating the tchum. Hey, Julie, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to stop and then
so you want to stop, but because you're with the caravan, there's no danger. The danger is if you're solo. Yes, Natalie.
How
do you explain tchum? Yeah, so tchum is the boundary outside of town beyond which you're not allowed to travel on Shabbos. Meaning, the Torah says when they're going to collect the mun, no one should leave their space on Shabbos, from that we understand that there is actually a rule of not traveling outside of your settled area on Shabbos. Now, defining settled area is tricky. Where are the boundaries of my town? If you're in Manhattan, you could go for a very long distance before you reach the end of your town, so to speak, before you even start counting the distance. Like, you'd have to work hard to violate Tchum from here. But it will happen in other places. It does. It does happen. You know, I grew up in Oceanside on Long Island, for those who are, you know, Long Islanders. So if you wanted to walk from Oceanside to Long Beach on Shabbos, there's a long bridge you have to traverse that may actually take you outside of the Tchum. That would be an example of it. Morale.
I don't know if you understand Jersey, but, like, you know Teaneck and Englewood?
I know what they are, yeah.
Okay, so, like, they're, like, a 45-minute walk, and, like, it's very common for people to have families, like, come for, like, lunch and, like,
right.
Meals.
So, right, so the question is whether there's a gap in between where you don't have houses, you don't have any, you know, any residences. If they're contiguous in terms of residences, like there are houses along the way, then you're fine.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like, what if there's a Jewish town in between that doesn't have an Arab? Like, does that affect?
No, doesn't affect it. As long as there are continued residences, you're going to be okay. So, Passaic, Clifton, you know, Englewood and whatever it is that's next to it, I forget.
Yeah.
Tenafly, is that?
Oh, Tenafly,
yeah. Like, they're just, you're just going, it's, the fact that we put a political boundary and say this is one town, this is another town, is irrelevant.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is an issue of air, not like being in the car, specifically, right? Like, this is just an air issue, because, like, they can't go in the car on
Shabbos. Right, so it's not correct. Well,
no,
this isn't Eruv.
Yeah.
This is, Tchum is a whole different thing. I mean, there is such a thing as Eruv Tchumen, but I'm not going there. But this is about not traveling. If the mechanism for travel is itself problematic, like you're driving a car, then yes, you have a separate problem. You know, yeah. This is any time, let's say you were camping, you were out camping somewhere, so you would have this travel distance from your tent. Yeah. So you can up to the Tchum. And again, the Tchum is you know, about a kilometer. Yeah.
So the bridge in between the towns can make it problematic?
So it can make it problematic if it's long enough, yeah.
So, like, on Shabbat, when you go on long walks, and there's, like, a bridge in between, you're supposed to not...
So, again, it depends on the distance without residences, you know, that it's traveling. I didn't intend for this to become a share about Tchum, so, yeah, I don't want to mislead anybody. But it's worth staying in a residential area. That's the upshot. So the Shulchan Aruch writes in number 6 that if you're on such a caravan and you're not driving a car, you're in a way that you could theoretically keep traveling on Shabbos, but you have the Tchum problem. So he says, arrange from the start that they're going to halt on Shabbos. That's what you're supposed to do. And if once they are in the wilderness, they don't want to halt, right? They say, forget it, we're not stopping. You paid them and everything, and you said, you know, we're going to stop for Shabbos, and they said, you bet. And then Shabbos comes, and now they don't want to stop. So what do you do? He says he may go with them outside the Tchum for the sake of safeguarding life. It's dangerous for you to just be there alone in the wilderness over Shabbos. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, also known as the Chafetz Chaim, wrote a work called the Mishneh Berurah in the beginning of the 20th century, right? 125 years ago or so. So he commented on this, and he says, why is it you don't want to wait in the wilderness? If he's afraid to wait in the wilderness lest wild animals encounter him, or lest bandits harm him and steal his animal, and he could not then go on foot, he would be endangered if he didn't have his animal. Or they might take his money, he couldn't keep himself alive in the wilderness, they might take his clothing, and it's cold. All of these are included in possible safeguarding of life, safek pikuach nefesh. And he may go with them. And that's really what I wanted to show you. We are concerned not only for pikuach nefesh saving lives, we are also concerned about safek pikuach nefesh potential risk to life. Now, hang on, Ricky. It's very important to recognize that safek is a big place. There are potential risks to life where it's like, I really could be in danger. And then there's potential risks to life because, yeah, maybe it could be risky. This came up a lot during the pandemic, right? The question came up, what if you know, you find out on Shabbos that somebody tested positive. They were in school the day before. Do you start calling everybody who was in the classroom so that they know that somebody there tested positive?
On Shabbos.
On Shabbos, right, that's what I'm, yeah. On Shabbos. Well, it depends. It depends on what your fear is, right? Are you dealing with people who are vulnerable? Are you dealing with people who are not vulnerable for whatever reason? Vaccination, prior disease, generally in a healthy category, you know, whatever it is. What if it's somebody who was in the class? Sure, but they have a grandparent at home who is vulnerable. Now do you start notifying them on Shabbos? It becomes very tricky to evaluate doubt. Ricky, you were going to say?
Yeah,
is Tumah or wow, is that a good question. I was hoping to duck that. The answer is it's a quantum halacha. Sometimes it's derabanan and sometimes it's d'oraisa. The meaning, the boundary I gave you, the 2,000 amos boundary, is generally assumed to be rabbinic. There is an opposing view. It's generally assumed to be rabbinic. However, there is a view that it's biblical, and there's a view that it's actually biblical if it's six times that length, 6 kilometers, in other words. So there's a lot to say about it. I see it's 11:39. So I'm gonna stop us here. But we have to figure out how to deal with the what if questions to make sure that we cover more ground, because I don't mind. I'm here learning Torah with you, but I do want people to get what they came for in the class also. Okay, thank you very much.